Hello and welcome to Sobre Mesa podcast. My name is Owen Gilmartin and Alan can't be here this week. I think he's on holidays, but luckily I have a very interesting guest, someone who I've been wanting to talk to for a long time. His work on contemporary Spain and Spanish politics is always very interesting. So I have with me Vicente Rubio Pueyo, who is lecturing in modern languages at Fordham University in New York. And he wrote a very interesting piece recently putting the Spanish electoral results from the 23rd of July in a sort of wider context of the last 15 years of Spanish politics and potentially where does Spain go next. So Vicente, thanks for joining me.
Thanks a lot for having me, Johan, and well, it's glad to be back here. Yeah, I was a few years back with
Alan, exactly. Yeah, I remember on municipalism, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And Vox, yeah.
And Vox, yeah.
One of the things I really, really liked that you've written was a long report for the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation on Vox, which was an early sort of in-depth analysis on the Spanish far right and Vox. So I think, you know, in English, it must have been probably the first in-depth piece published, I imagine, no?
Wow. Yeah. It was pretty early. Yeah. But thanks a lot. I mean, it has many reads, and I was very happy to have the opportunity to both to write it and also to discuss it with Alan a few years back.
So I mean, I think we've done an initial sort of episode reacting to the election results. So I think in this, I mean, I really enjoyed your piece in the Latin American version of Jacobin, and looking at going towards a new conjuncture in Spain, a new political moment. In some ways, these election results came as a surprise. They seem to, in some ways, book the trend in Europe more generally as a move to the right. But as you say, in it, in some ways, it reflects the plurality, you know, the sort of the existing plural Spain, as opposed to the sort of idea of Spain in the right wing, in the minds of the Spanish right, basically. No, so I mean, I guess my first question is, how would you evaluate these results? And how would you place them, I guess, in the wider context of Spanish politics over the last sort of decade of sort of crises, I guess?
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Yeah, great question. I think there are a lot of things there, so I'm going to try to break down like in different pieces. But basically, I mean, there were like a few motivations that I had in writing the essay for Jacobin. First of all, I think it was like this combination of that. It was a surprise. It was something that the results were unexpected. But at the same time, it was sort of like a confirmation, I think.
Yeah.
A confirmation in the sense that it was, well, those results were basically a repetition with slight variations.
Yes.
of the results of the 2019. Then I think this made me think a couple of things. Basically, what the results show is that there is like a real country beyond the polling and media discourses that have been like overwhelming within the last few years or months. Even. So basically, as we were talking about before beginning the recording, I was in Spain during the campaign, and my first reaction at a very personal level is that I was kind of shocked when I arrived to Spain end of June, and everyone was convinced that the right is going to win. Right.
Yeah.
It's like there's nothing we can do, etc. I was kind of, I don't know, I was like this outsider guy coming from the States. It's like I was sort of optimistic. Okay, maybe we can still do something. Maybe the campaign is going to change things. But I don't know, my parents, my family, friends, etc. It's like, okay, you know, there was like this fatalism
It is true. I mean, I think it affected me as well in the sense of, I think when you're living in the country and every day there's a new poll saying there's going to be an absolute majority for the right. I mean, I think what you say in your piece is correct. I mean, I think until the local results, maybe I did have that sense, okay, Madrid is not Spain. There isn't an actual majority for this type of right-wing nationalism. But then slowly, poll after poll, and it does become a sense, you know, inevitable in one sense. It sort of, you know, it becomes a political weapon to sow the sort of hopelessness, no?
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I saw very clearly, that kind of fatalism, like, installed. And I couldn't avoid to wonder if maybe there were, like, a sort of opposite fatalism, positive fatalisms to be discussed, which is that basically, well, no matter how powerful the right is, and it's very powerful, no matter how many polls and how many like insistence in the mainstream media about this triumph of the right, the result of the 2019 elections, which were actually
two elections.
Show very clearly that, well, there was like this plural Spain, the weight of the independentist party in the Basque Country, in Catalonia, a stronger left, very present in parliament with Unidas Podemos. Well, the PSOE also like maintaining like this very important central role, etc. And for me, I think it was very difficult to imagine that that landscape was going to change substantially, even with all this offensive of the right, right, or this reactionary wave, which we can discuss maybe later. So basically, yeah, I thought that the elements were still there somehow, and that was for me very, very, very important to keep in mind. And I was of course shocked about this role of the demoscopia, right, of the polling analyst, of the experts in political communications, etc. For me, I think that what's important is to highlight is that, yeah, no matter the importance of this reactionary wave, the project of the right basically is not viable because they are alone. They are obviously, they have two of the main four parties in the country. They are very strong. They are half of the country, basically. And we can also talk about the two Spains. Yeah. All over again, always.
Yeah.
So there is one Spain there, and that's for sure, and no question about it. But at the same time, they don't have, even if they are so strong, they are not strong enough to really build an hegemony with that. Because, well, on the other side, we are all the rest of us, basically.
Yeah.
With a very diverse side, with many different currents, many different concerns, many different priorities, etc. But then basically there's a whole other country there. And I don't think the right as it is now is able to really win over anyone from the other side. And basically, of course, they are extremely strong. They have like power of the certain state apparatuses, the media, of course, economic power, political power of all kinds. But at the same time, I don't know, I think they are missing still something that they cannot really get. And I think they thought that they were going to win this time. But I think it's important to stress from these results that they were not able to. And it's not the first time that they are not able to. So basically, also there is one aspect of these elections, these results, that basically, even if we are in the left, for example, we are celebrating and we are very happy about the result, but I think we are not even kind of realizing how important it was that they didn't win this time. Because basically, it's not the first time that happens. And somehow, for me, it's important to think about how this repetition of 2019 is basically a sort of buying some time or gaining some time for a sort of like prolonging a sort of long interregnum period that has been open since the financial crisis of 2008, right? Basically. And then we can go now maybe to the more like conjunctural analysis that you were asking me about. Basically, what I understand is I'm writing or finishing a book about this, and it's basically very based on this conjunctural analysis by Stuart Hall, etc. But basically, it's like if you apply that framework to the history of Spanish democracy, you see like, well, Stuart Hall used to talk about there are like these settlements, right? And then these settlements are broken by periods of crisis, right? So basically, you have in the Spanish democracy, you have the settlement of 1978.
Yeah.
Basically, all these points of consensus, very broad points of consensus of whole democratic framework for the right and for the left, and that basically structured the whole trajectory of Spanish democracy until, from 1978 to 2008, right? Of course, with different types of hegemony, this turnism, right, between the socialists and the conservatives, with certain different modulation, different interpretations of those consensus according to different correlations of power throughout time. But then, 2008, of course, as we know, with the economic crisis, well, it's the economic and financial crisis, but of course, it opens, in the case of Spain, a very different aspects of critical aspects, right? It's like there is an economic economic crisis, but also a political crisis, an institutional crisis, even the monarchy, right? Experiencing a crisis. And a cultural and ideological crisis in the end. Basically, it's like how you could say it's a sort of identity crisis of the country as such. It's like change our situation or even our self-perception in, as a country in the world, right? From being among the, I don't know, most powerful countries in the world somehow. It was a bit triumphalistic at the time, but somehow it was a narrative that was working for many people. And going to the second division of countries after the crisis. And I think that's something that, of course, things have changed throughout the years, but still there somehow in the horizon. And then basically, so you have 2008, 2011, when the May 15 movement, the 15 M starts. And we've been like basically all this last decade, we've been in this sort of interregnum period, crisis period where the previous settlement is basically not completely destroyed, of course, but very weakened by the situation, and nobody really thinks about in the same terms anymore. At the same time, there's not a new settlement that has been built. There has been like different interpretations of how to solve this or how to propose new elements for a settlement. First, we had the progressive or the leftist interpretation of that with Podemos and the municipalismos in 2015, etc. That then gave way to another period where there was a more like a reactionary interpretation of that, which basically Vox, I think we can understand it, not even as a party, which it, of course it obviously is, but it's more like a symptom of or a vehicle or a tool for a certain closure of the crisis along reactionary and even proto-authoritarian terms. So it's like basically returning to Stuart Hall, for example, to borrow a title by Stuart Hall, it's been like since the process, the independence referendum in Catalonia, and on all this right-wing reaction, it has been like basically, to quote Stuart Hall, this great moving right show, right? Basically, where we have like all this more and more stronger, like radical right context, of course, influenced by Trump and the whole global context, but basically as an attempt by different political and economic forces to give a solution to the crisis, but of course their solution, right? Which is basically, we need a more centralized state. We need to recover like this sort of nationalistic pride in ourselves, all other elements, but basically we need to close with this period of stability and experimentation and this growing threat by this big like leftist forces, right? Because the left was usually not so big as now. Basically, I think that's part of the landscape. And as I said, basically, these results are not definitive. Of course, it's very provisional, but my question in the article basically is, can this be, because it's a repetition of 2018, can this be like the beginning of a sort of formation of a new, are we going maybe towards a new type of conjuncture? Not maybe a settlement, but a new kind of phase or where there can be elements for hopefully a new kind of settlement that is more progressive and plurinational.
I mean, obviously what you're saying, we can see sort of similar crises of representation, institutional and economic crises in other, European and, Western countries with the sort of, I guess it's a crisis of neoliberalism, isn't it? The neoliberal consensus, whether in the United States, you can look at the UK with, obviously with Brexit, with the rise of Corbyn, etc. We can look at what's happening in France at the moment, with the riots, various popular movements from the Yellow Jackets onwards. The complete collapse of the French traditional party system, which in its case, the figure around which we've had a certain provisional stabilization, obviously, is a more right wing figure in Macron. In Spain, you had, yeah, as you were saying, and you lay it in your piece. I mean, we're talking about five elections in the last 7 years. I mean, last 7.5 years, potentially a sixth by Christmas if there can't be an agreement. I think there probably will be, but you know, it's a very volatile situation in which I think, as you lay out in your piece, the sort of there's been a certain stabilization around the figure of Pedro Sanchez, his ability to read, you know, against the sort of old guard of his party, against the sort of, you know, media and economic class of the country, the need both to reach out to Podemos and to Catalan independents, etc. And so we've seen a certain stabilization, but maybe just to continue first on this idea of the Spanish conjuncture. I mean, it's, I guess, in some ways, and this is, we're going to come to your the comparison you make between Sanchez and Adolfo Suarez, his role in the previous Spanish transition or moment of crisis 40 years ago. But one of the descriptions, you know, the Spanish transition was in a sense a moment of a correlation of weaknesses, no? Like, in a sense, you had this impasse between two blocks. Neither could assert their hegemony over the other. And in some ways, what you're describing the current moment in Spain is in some ways somewhat similar, in the sense that, as you said, the right wing have huge weight within the state institutions, in the media, the economic, you know, when you think of Madrid as a sort of, you know, global economic hub connecting Europe and Latin America, etc. I mean, the right have important weight in all those areas. You have an electoral system which is also weighted towards, you know, rural areas in which the right tend to do well, conservative forces. So they have all that going for them. But yeah, as you said, they don't have enough. They still don't have the capacity to assert, to firstly win a general election. You know, we've had five over the last 7.5 years. We can talk about, obviously, 2015, there should have been a progressive government back then. Why there wasn't, we could discuss about that. But the point is, Have we moved beyond this, I guess, this correlation of weaknesses, this sort of catastrophic impasse, to quote Linera, no? Garcia Linera, or our previous guest on the show, Carlos de Clos, described Spain as a country without a political majority. And there does seem to be these two quite evenly weighted blocks. I think you're right that the sort of plurinational progressive bloc has the edge, but it too doesn't necessarily have the capacity to impose a project or a new consensus or a new, you know. So is it fair to describe this current moment as another moment of a correlation of weaknesses rather than of strengths, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Many things there. Yeah,
it's, that was my rant. Sorry.
It's okay. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's this. Of course, yeah, this expression is by Manuel Vázquez Montalbán. It's the correlations of
the writer. Yeah,
correlation de debilidad. Yeah. Which is exactly. It's a very graphic way to explain the transition for sure. And I guess that also the current moment at a certain extent. First of all, maybe I wonder, and I have no solution or no answer for this, but basically I kind of experience that I feel that this current catastrophic impasse or a correlation of weaknesses, etc., is something that is very common right now. For example, yeah, it's happening right now here in the States, for example. It's basically you have the conservative media says that it's polarization, which is not really, because it's a very kind of like a trap, because it's like this sort of equidistant, right? Consideration of both sides, the extremes are both feeding into this polarization, which is not the case. I mean, there are, one side is defending rights and of the people and minorities or different sexual identities, etc. Another side is basically attacking those rights and attacking basic human rights all over the world. So it's like basically, but of course, yeah, this idea of polarization, even if it's false, it expresses also this kind of, we live in right now, at least in Europe and America, very political system that are structured along two blocks, right? And it's really difficult to, I don't know, some years ago, I think things were more like fluid, more like you were able to, I don't know, this transversality discourses about how to reach out to different voters. Everything was more like sort of information. But now, yeah, it's, everything is very solid, very, very strong, and it's really, really, really difficult to get across, to reach out to voters from the other side. And again, I think, yeah, one aspect of it is, you mentioned it, and it's, of course, a huge thing, a very complex discussion, but it's basically, yeah, it's a crisis of neoliberalism, basically, and which, of course, takes different expressions in different countries. But, of course, what I see is that, for example, part of this crisis is, of course, that I think, for example, we need to understand this new, like, post-fascism, like Trump, like Vox, like other phenomena, as basically, in a way, what I was saying of, like, a reactionary exit of the yeah. crisis of 2008. Well, in a global context, I think there are, it's also this authoritarian, this anti-democratic, this reactionary answer, which is, of course, it's not that the powerful wants to do that. It's like a sort of conspiracy. But obviously, there are certain blocks, certain sectors of capital that are interested in such a an exit. Such yeah. a, so other not, of course, there of are course. Also progressive sectors of capitalism, etc. But I think that explains a lot about this polarization. Basically, it's polarization created by the right and a right supported by sectors of capital, basically. Then, what else? Yeah, going back to Spain, basically, I think, yeah, you could say that, yeah, it's a correlation of weaknesses. I think that it's like we have like these two perfect sides defined. And basically, of course, it's, in the case of Spain, it's always again and again the two Spains, right? Problem coming back again and again. I think what it's interesting right now is like there has been also different changes. I think for me, what I'm tempted to say is that, yeah, I feel that the right, Vox and Pepe, of course, they are basically half of the country, that's for sure. At the same time, they are alone because, yeah, they are unable to build any kind of cooperation or collaboration beyond themselves. What I would be tempted to say is that, well, this situation will change the moment where Pepe, for example, Vox is a different story, but the moment where Pepe tries maybe to return to the center somehow. It's like as Aznar somehow, I mean, Aznar is basically the creator of Vox in a way, in a direct yeah. way, long ago. But at the same, at least for some years, it was a very different situation, of course, economically, socially, historically, in the 90s. But well, at that moment, the PP was aware that they need to cooperate with the right-wing nationalists, right, with Convergencia Unión, Catalonia, yeah. and Partido Nacionalista Vasco in the Basque Country. I mean, part of the crisis that the political crisis in Spain throughout the last decade is that, of course, also, and this is another like reading of the last results, is that the whole system has changed in Spain, right? We are not anymore in basically a two-party system with PP and PSOE. We have Unidas Podemos, or now Sumar. We have Vox to the right. We used to have Ciudadanos, also in the center-right, etc. But another dimension of this change of the political system has been, of course, the changes in the Catalonia and Basque Country themselves, basically. Yes. It's very telling that, for example, right now, I think this is the first time that Bildu is now has overcome Partido Nacionalista Vasco as the first Basque for political yes. force in Spanish Parliament. And it's very telling that, of course, I think it's really interesting the way in which Bildu are reading the situation. And it's, this may seem scandalous for many people, but I think that Bildu is really providing the most intelligent readings of the situation right now. From their side, their situation, of course, according to their priorities, etc. But they are very cooperative, forming the progressive government, etc. And the situation in Catalonia also has changed. I mean, we witnessed how Esquerra became also the first Catalan force. Now it's not the case anymore because they lost also many votes. There are also the dynamics between Esquerra and Junts in Catalonia. But again, it's also that there are also this level of the Spanish political system is one that needs to be accounted for, and how then can modulate different aspects. What I see is that basically also on that level, there is a much stronger role of the left parties this case, Bildu and Esquerra, than it used to be like in the 90s or the early 2000s, where basically you had both the socialists and the Popular Party. They needed to cooperate always with right-wing forces, which were the PNV and Convergencia Union. But that's not the thing anymore. So I don't know. That's one.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you say in your pieces, Spain has moved from a two-party system to a bibloquismo, no? And it's sort of like a two-block system. And it's so the dynamic within those blocks is also interesting in that sense. That's one of my, in one sense, clearly makes sense for the PP to move more towards the center to try and be able to reach out to certain people. But it's quite difficult when they have Vox on their right flank. I mean, I guess there's two potential ways out of this crisis for that, or two potential ways towards a majority of seats for the PP, is that one is go towards the center. Yeah, I guess either try and improve their own vote in the Basque Country or in Catalonia, or be able to work with some of these parties. Though, I mean, in the case of Catalonia, it's very hard to see. The other is to go full Trump, to go Ayuso and compete with Vox, try and get a majority of seats by basically reducing Vox down to a rump. And, Spain doesn't have a proportional system. It does favor the right. I think it's a pre-constitutional electoral system, basically. No, it's, one designed by the old Francoist regime that does more, it is much more proportional than either the US or the UK. So, I mean, it's not by far the worst out there, but it does more heavily weight the rural vote, where the Popular Party tends to do better, etc. So, I mean, obviously they have, as you say, you have this two-block system now. The dynamic within the right-wing bloc makes, I think, any move towards the center quite difficult in some ways.
No, you're totally right. I mean, that's why I was saying that I'm tempted to say that they should do this or that, but of course they are not going to do that. Not immediately. Because also there is also another dimension of the results right now. I mean, the contrast between the results of the national election and the municipal election. And we need to see now how it's going to play out. It's like basically we are talking about this sort of like two countries, two blocks in the national system, but of course the results of the municipal and autonomic elections, what has gave us is basically a landscape totally dominated by the right wing. Yes. And basically we are going to see there are like four autonomous communities or even five maybe where PP and Vox are going to govern together. So it's like it's really interesting. I mean, it's really tragic and fucked up. How it's going to play out. So that's why then, at least in the short term, I don't think that the PP is going to move from that. My impression is that, of course, there are like critical voices within the PP that are kind of like raising questions about, okay, we should maybe revise this strategy, etc. But of course, then, there is, first of all, the reality, the fact that they are going to govern within the next few years with Vox in many places. And at the same time, you mentioned that already, Ayuso, which is basically the most prominent figure, and she's poised to be the successor of Feijó. One thing, as a side note, but also this is another discussion maybe about the dynamics within the right bloc. For example, the role of Ayuso, which I don't know, maybe I'm naive or I'm always too optimistic somehow, but I have the impression that even if she's clearly the favorite to succeed Feijó as the leader of the Popular Party, I kind of have the hunch that she would not work so well in the rest of the country as in Madrid. Madrid is a very special case, a very specific thing.
Yeah.
There is a whole like political culture. It's been like, I don't know, decades of hegemony of PP, it's their laboratory, etc. There is the social composition of a capital city is very particular, with a lot of functionaries, or like conservative bent, if you like, in many places. I don't know, many factors that explain also how it was possible. Yeah, Esperanza Aguirre first, some years ago, and then Ayuso as the sort of natural heir of that. And then I don't think she can have some traction, of course, and maybe she can basically devour Vox everywhere. But at the same time, I don't know, there is a certain more like traditionally conservative voter of the PP, in which basically I think that it was well represented by Rajoy, for example. This more like this quiet figure with not so many. And I don't know, I think what Feijóo tried to do during the campaign, I think it was to balance out this sort of Trumpist tactics with trying to, I don't know, appeal to this more conservative voter. I think in the end it was a disaster, because also I think the image of Feijóo as this quiet, honest man of the provinces, etc., it was actually a lie. It was a fallacy.
Yeah.
It has been all the time. But it was especially so when everything, like basically his campaign, broke down.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I think that's true. Like, I mean, I think given the ideological support of the PP in the Madrid-based media, etc., I mean, he had to lean into that line. And I think at the end of the day, it was like Sanchismo or Spain. No, I mean, it's the same sort of technique. As such, maybe it doesn't go to the same degree as Pablo Casado before him, but it is along the same lines. And as you say in your piece, there wasn't much more to his campaign but anti-Sanchismo. You're with your piece. I mean, the last sort of long section of your piece deals with Pedro Sanchez and how to understand him as a historical figure. And you put forward two sort of main hypotheses. And then you've also mentioned this comparison with Adolfo Suarez, the prime minister from the transition. Can you first maybe explain what you mean by that comparison? Because as you said to me beforehand as well, like, a lot of people will be horrified by this comparison, or will be, you know, outraged that you would make such a comparison. But explain what you see there as what's the similarity? Or
exactly. So I think in the article I talk about Sanchez as this vanishing mediator, right? Which is this theoretical concept of psychoanalysis. We can explain it later. But originally, I think actually it was my initial idea, but then I didn't mention it directly in the text. But this idea of Suarez as vanishing mediator comes from a comparison between Sanchez and Suarez. Because I wrote an essay years ago about Anatomía de un Instante, this book by...
This
book of
it's an interesting book.
About the transition. Really interesting, really, I don't know, ideologically...
Problematic. I think, what year did the book come out? Because the ending...
2007, maybe?
Right before the crisis, because it is... Yeah. It's the last sort of swan song of that transition consensus. I mean, the last, I remember the last transition, you know, basically, and Spain became a modern European welfare state was basically how he finishes the book. And of course, the next year you have the financial crisis. So, but it is, as a work of sort of historical, I mean, so, what is he, a true fiction or whatever he describes his works as? It's an interesting work. It's an interesting analysis of that moment. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, it was actually it was one of the chapters of my dissertation originally. So it's like I've read this book a lot of times, and again, it's ideologically problematic. It's sort of like this narrative that I criticize a lot when I've written about it. But of course, it's a very kind of brilliant in its way book because it's like it provides a sort of overview of transition, etc., and focusing, of course, in the figure, in the individual figure of Suarez. And then what you can see there is like basically this figure of Suarez as this paradoxical figure where he's coming from the Francoist regime, but he's trying to renew that regime. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, as Cercas explains, basically it's like this Francoist guy, but then he begins to truly believe in democracy somehow and transform itself in this pro-democratic, very strongly pro-democratic figure. At the same time, he's starting to become alone in Madrid as a president, etc. So the last months or the last couple of years of Suarez in the government before the attempt of coup d'etat in 1981, basically is this solitude of Suarez in the power, right? He's the president, but basically everyone is conspiring against him.
Yes.
So basically that's what Cercas is telling in the book. And in a way, I think this is not what Cercas says, but somehow it's implied in his literary work. But then what I try to explain theoretically is like, basically Suarez be considered as a vanishing mediator of the Spanish transition, in the sense that this figure, the vanishing mediator in psychoanalysis, is basically this figure that mediates between two, let's say very simply, two states of mind or two psychological configurations or two situations, right?
Yes. So
it's basically sometimes you need in your life, maybe in your life, in your relationships, etc., one person that helps you to get out from a certain situation and then move into a new situation. But sometimes this mediator is something that actually helps you to do that, to achieve that. But after that, it disappears. It doesn't have a function anymore. It just like helps you to change into that situation. But then, and that's why, yeah, it's vanishing, right? It's a mediator, but that vanishes after accomplishing its function, its goal, which was precisely in the case of Suárez, for example, somehow contacting, driving the Spanish politics from the Francoist regime to the democracy. And then after all, then his historical mission was accomplished. So then he wasn't...
He disappears, he vanishes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, and then comparing Suárez with Sánchez, what happened, of course, I was telling you, might seem scandalous for many people, but of course Suárez was extremely criticized and everyone was conspiring against him during the transition and during, I mean, right before the coup d'etat. It was a coup d'etat by the military and probably the king and many other people against Suárez. But of course then, as every vanishing mediator, after he vanishes, he became this sacred figure, right? It's like right now, for example, the Madrid Airport, Barajas is called Adolfo Suárez Airport, etc. This consecration of this figure, which was then very respected after he was a useless political figure. After he was out of politics, then, okay, now we can revere to him, we can consider him this, the first democratic president of Spanish democracy, etc. So, etc. But during his political life, he suffered all kind of pressures, all kind of conspiracies against him, all kinds of tensions. The comparison could be, it could be scandalous because, of course, then for many people that revere Suárez and consider Suárez this sacred figure beyond discussion, Sánchez represents basically the opposite. He's basically just an opportunist. But by the way, Suárez was considered an opportunist at the time.
Yeah.
Or just this opportunist, this hypocrite, etc., all this kind of thing. But I think that there are like formal parallels, if you like, in the sense that, for example, the way in which Sánchez can be considered a very kind of lonesome figure. It's like he was expelled from the leadership of the PSOE when he was first the general secretary there, and he didn't accept to.
So he was expelled for refusing to back a Rajoy minority government and wanting a left wing coalition with Podemos, etc.
Then of course it's all this narrative that in the end has been extremely helpful for him, that he was expelled from the leadership, then he started like going through all over Spain with his car, right? And then talking to the militants in every city, etc. And then in the end he won the primaries of the PSOE again, and then he became leader again, etc. The thing is that what I tried to say in the article, for example, it's true that this discourse about Sanchismo, right, that the right wing uses, the right media, the Feijóo, the Vox, etc., of course, it's a propagandistic tool. It's a way to weaken Sánchez. But it has like sort of this like kernel of truth, in the sense of that maybe because of that past of Sánchez and his relationship with the old guard of the PSOE, it's true that probably, there's not so much consensus within PSOE to support Sánchez. Or PSOE is always divided in like these two souls, right? It's like basically a more like raison d'etat, right? The reason of state, these state responsibilities. Some people say that sometimes PSOE looks more like a ministry than
a party, state, exactly, right? a mass party. Yeah, exactly.
So basically, it's divided into these two souls. And then, of course, Sánchez is his president, obviously, but at the same time, he seems maybe to be more supported from people that are not really within the structure of the PSOE itself. Of course, he has like his advisors and his supporters, so that's out of the question. But probably, he's in a weaker position than other general secretaries of the PSOE in the past. So I don't know. There's a certain kernel of truth in that, maybe. Or at least, of course, always the right tries to, and the old guard of the PSOE, I mean, Felipe González and other basically the people from the not Zapatero, which has been very supportive of Sanchez, especially in this last campaign. He played a really key role, I think. But yeah, of course, all the old guard of the PSOE has always been trying to destabilize the leadership of Sanchez one way or another. Then, yeah, but beyond that, I mean, there is this comparison, like these two figures as punishing mediators. Then, in the case of Sanchez, what I use this figure of the vanishing mediator because I think it was helpful for me to try to understand his role as historical figure, his role right now in different ways. Maybe, of course, first of all, maybe because everything is so unclear right now.
Exactly.
The figure came handy. Well, okay, maybe we have this guy and then it's going to... It's a sort of mediation figure, a transitional figure, because we still don't know what is going to what await us, right? In the future. So let's choose this sort of transitional figure to explain things. But basically, what I think is like, of course, we have this bibloquismo, the division in Spanish politics. There is not like a possibility of a settlement in the coming future. I don't think there is. But of course, maybe transitionally, I think this repetition of the results of 2019, this plurality, this plural Spain there, which then Sanchez as its president. It can represent certain element towards a new kind of settlement in the far future. And then Sanchez can be considered not so much as the absolute leader of that, but more like a sort of figure that can be helpful in achieving that somehow. In a way, I was trying to also diminish maybe the protagonism of Sanchez as such, because I think, of course, I think he has lots of merits and one has to acknowledge that as a political figure. He's very clever, I think. He's very astute, etc. But at the same time, I think it's like, as we were discussing beforehand, he doesn't seem to really have a strong political project for the country. He's basically dealing with these short-term decisions, etc. Very clever decisions always, what to do in the short term, but he doesn't really have a project behind him. But then, of course, we can sort of, talking from the left, we can sort of, this guy is here, so let's use him somehow to gain more forces and then elaborate a more ambitious project for the country. And for the time being, well, he's the president because, also the role of the PSOE is really interesting if you think about the politics in Spain in the last years, right? Because I was mentioning, we are in this interregnum, and then we had the progressive or the leftist proposal or hypothesis with Podemos, with Municipalismos, etc. We have the reactionary right-wing hypothesis with Vox and the reconfiguration of the right and the PP. But PSOE, throughout these years, has never proposed anything. Basically, he's just like been in the middle, kind of waiting to see what to do and where to go, right? So it's like...
I do agree in that sense, because I think you're right. Like, any sort of idea of a definitive transition or new consensus emerging, you know, when you look elsewhere, it clearly hasn't emerged either. But like, I guess in Spain, for example, there have been moves around the territorial crisis, obviously over the last 4 years, and any new government will require further steps, potentially even an amnesty, you know, around people involved to the Catalan independence push from 2017. It is true that you can imagine a more stable territorial model emerging, maybe largely out of necessity. I mean, you know, 4 years ago when Sanchez ran in November 2019, he ran very much, you know, on a quite a strict line on Catalonia, but then was forced, given the parliamentary arithmetic, he was forced, you know, to make major concessions towards Esquerra Republicana and the Catalan parties around, you know, the pardons for the leaders, around changing the law, around various offences, etc., criminal offences relating to the independence movement, etc. So he is an agile figure. He's willing. He understands he has to go in that direction, and he is willing to when he has to. I think what you're saying about the left is an interesting one as well. But obviously, you know, with Sumar now likely to have another 4 years in government, but in a moment where it's not clear what's going to happen internationally, the sort of fiscal space seems to be narrowing. We have interest rates, you know, right? You know, the ECB, European Central Bank, is continuing to raise interest rates in line with Bank of England, the Fed, etc. Can this sort of progressive plurinational coalition, I guess, move forward on these various fronts? I mean, even the fact that you're going to have more right wing elements in there, you know, the Junts's seven seats, whatever it is going to be crucial. I mean, one of the outstanding sort of reforms, which, you know, there hasn't really been enough movement on, is around tax reform, progressive tax reform. I mean, I was talking to one Sumar MP just before the elections, and he was saying, you know, in the last 4 years, we've passed these, you know, important emergency measures, a temporary emergency wealth tax, a temporary windfall tax on banks, on the electrics. But it's how do you now consolidate a meaningful tax regime in Spain, et cetera, that can go beyond sort of just a two-year emergency tax, et cetera. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously all these things are up in the air.
No, absolutely. And at the same time, to be honest, it's like I speak in these terms of like, yeah, this following all, right? Like, yeah, we have like this alternancy of settlements and then crisis and,
yes,
and then another settlement, etc. But sometimes I wonder, to be honest, is like we are in a historical period, a historical moment that maybe doesn't allow anymore. It's like, I don't mean this as a criticism to Hall, which is my main theoretical figure, someone that I admire infinitely. But somehow I think that, yeah, this alternancy of settlements and crisis, I don't know, it was somehow possible to think in the 20th century. And now it's like the degree of uncertainty is so much that, yeah. I mean, I'm talking about, because that's where I come from, and I think about in Gramscian terms of hegemony or these kind of things.
Yes.
And then it's like, okay, yeah, we need to build like some kind of settlement, some kind of new agreement in a society to go forward, right? And then, of course, that it's made with concessions, with gains, with victories,
yes,
with defeats, etc., all these kind of things. At the same time, it's true that, if I'm honest, that's why, yeah, these results, I think, show us a path forward, a possible path. But at the same time, I mean, the uncertainty is absolute. And maybe
what do you see as that path? Is it movement on the territorial issue? And
no, I mean that maybe sooner or later, I guess, I hope that, for example, yeah, a new kind of territorial model should be like discussed and vote openly and in a way, I mean, to maybe, I don't want to sound voluntaristic, but I still think that, for example, the horizon of a sort of constituent process is something that it's worth fighting for, in a way, because it's like, it's about, yeah, the new, maybe not a whole new constitution, but yeah. Of course, it's like a new kind of agreement in a strong sense. But at the same time, what I was saying is that's kind of the direction, the project, because I think we need to renew very profound things about the functioning of the country and also in relation to the international context, etc. At the same time, maybe we are entering a historical period where not only in Spain, but everywhere, it's impossible to reach this kind of agreement. At the same time that I kind of try to think in positive terms of how, what elements can guide us to build new settlements, then maybe at the same time that there are so many uncertainties going on at so many levels, like international level, global economy, etc., that it's really, and then the division is so strong that then I don't really know what is the way out of this or a way to solve this somehow. I mean, probably there will be at some point, very long term. But I mean, if I think, for example, in the States where I live, it's kind of the same. It's like, I don't know, how do you get out of this? Like,
exactly. Yeah.
We can pass all the time. And it's all the time over and over again. And it's like, yeah, you can see two sides. And then how you build a new settlement when the fact of building a new settlement means to discuss such radical things that probably for one side or the other are totally like
exactly. No, it's you know,
essentially menacing somehow.
Or one of the few examples, I guess, internationally of an explicit, you know, of an explicit constituent process was obviously Chile, no, which mm-hmm. ended in sort of disaster for progressive forces. And so it is. I mean, when there isn't, if you don't have the means to create these type of consensuses, it can be very difficult. And yeah, I mean, I guess that's the thing is, yeah, a figure like Sanchez in that context is an interesting one, who can you're just very adept at sort of tactical maneuvers over short spaces, but not, I guess, the figure of from the crisis of 40 years ago, which Stuart Hall analyzed the most, was obviously Thatcher. And, you know, Thatcher, he was very interested in Thatcher as very much an ideologue, a figure who had a very clear ideological project. And at a moment of the crisis of the post-war welfare state, social democratic consensus, could sort of, you know, open that up and radically transform it. And in a sense, Sanchez and maybe Suarez as well were quite distinct figures in that sense, that there was a much greater element of opportunism, and, you know, but how far can that, I mean, I guess maybe that's enough in one sense. No, when you have, and you have these other elements at play, you have the left trying to give you, you know, trying to force their agenda on board. You have the Catalan and Basque nationalists with their desire for reforms of the state, and then obviously concessions around territorial powers, etc. And I guess, yeah, what do you see the role here of Yolanda Díaz and Sumar? I guess that would be one of my final questions.
Mm-hmm. No, so yeah, and I was exactly thinking about that. For example, I mean, just related to what we were just discussing, for example, I think that one very good thing about Sumar that people, I think, don't mention so much is that all the work that has been doing within Sumar in different working groups, for example, to elaborate this huge, like, very ambitious program in different aspects like ecology, economy, feminism, there has been, like, so many working groups, right? And I think that sometimes many people criticize Sumar because, yeah, they're undefined, they have no program, etc. Well, it's not true. I mean, there's like a lot of work that has been done over many months before the municipal elections, before the general elections, and that's work that, well, it's gonna prove useful and important, I think, in the medium and long term, I think. And because I think another very good thing about Sumar, I think, despite also many other criticisms that can be made, but it's true that Yolanda Díaz and her team have always pushed forward this idea of, well, we need a long-term vision, right, for the next 10 years, etc. And I think that these kind of messages maybe are not very attractive to great, like, swaths of the electorate, or are not very spectacular somehow. I don't know, maybe they only attract, like, some political freaks or people interested in hegemony and this kind of concept, etc. But I think that it's a work that maybe it's going to be important in the medium and long term. About Sumar, well, it's, first of all, well, the results, I mean, there's been, like, the discussions of if they're, like, worse than Podemos. I mean, they certainly are. They lost, like, some parliamentary seats, some also 700,000 votes, I think. But at the same time, I think one has to take into account, well, the climate of this current election, and then how I think the figure of Sanchez again has framed everything in a sort of, like, useful vote, and then that has, I think, attracted many votes from the left to the Socialist Party. I think the results are fine for Sumar right now, given the circumstances. And I think that, as I was saying with the program, also I think that Sumar has already, like, some important achievement in its account. Like, for example, I think the way in which Sumar has helped to build this agreement, a very maybe basic, general, vague, precarious agreement within between, like, 15 forces in the Spanish left at the national state, national level, I think it's an important achievement. Of course, then I tend to see this as a starting point, and everything in politics is contingent, is provisional, is precarious, many things can happen. But at the same time, I think it's like it's a good starting point according to the circumstances, according to the reactionary wave, and according also to the situation in which the left was until now. I think that, for example, for me, it's really important to stress that, the situation in which the left was until now, I think it was a sort of cul-de-sac, right? So it's like, well, Podemos has a lot to do with that. I mean, I say this, but of course, at the same time, in any consideration about the Spanish left, one has to start from 2 points, I think, regarding Podemos. First of all, is that what Podemos has achieved is really historic, like the way in which, for example, yeah, for the first time since the Second Republic in the 30s, there has been a force to the left of the Socialist Party in the government, and that's a really historic achievement. And second point, of course, is like the way of that Pablo Iglesias and Irene Montero and all the leadership of Podemos has been basically attacked.
Yeah, criminalized,
etc. Has been, I mean, scandalous, I think, and it's really a shame. And it's a, and even beyond them, it's like it shows a lot of the state of the media in Spain, of the journalism in Spain, of the, I mean, it's a symptom of a huge democratic problem in the country, I think, and one has to highlight that over anything else. At the same time, I think that, unfortunately, and I think, I don't know, this is just me thinking aloud, but I think I understand that at a human level, the way in which the Podemos leadership has reacted to that, I totally understand, and I like solidarize myself with them without a question. But at the same time, I think that somehow the way in which they have then reacted politically and behaved politically in the last times is basically a victory of the enemy. Basically, I always think about this quote by Machiavelli, which is basically when you go into a fortress, you are lost to the war and you are lost to politics. Basically, it's like, yeah, that's what the enemy wants, right? They want you in a fortress. And basically, Podemos has become a fortress in the last few years for very understandable reasons. But at the same time, I think it's like it has become organization and a political language and many other things that is really leaves no space for the left in the long term. Maybe it can have like its base, its followers, and it's very important and very respectable, and one has to take into account that and respect that and also relate to that and cooperate with that. That's out of the question. But at the same time, I think this is like it's a force that was condemned to basically very slowly or even rapidly to disappear, to evaporate. One concept that is very useful for to understand Podemos for me is like by Paolo Gerbaudo, this Italian.
Sociologist.
And he has this book about the digital parties, right? And he
described I have it on that bookshelf just behind me. Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. So it's a great book, and he has really great books. In this one in particular, for example, he described this structure of the digital parties as an empty pyramid, right? So basically, you have like the leadership and then the followers. Like followers, even in a literal like social media sense.
Yeah.
But then you don't have like the structure of more like cadre. Or, like,
there's no intermediary.
Bodies or people, workers there. And that I think Podemos is like basically trapped in that consequences of that structure that at a certain point they
and do you see, I mean, do you see Sumar as having overcome that structure? Because it seems a very top heavy. At the moment, organization,
No, absolutely. Again, of course, that's something that it remains to be seen.
Yes, so, yeah.
They are going to have the foundational assembly in September, I think, or in the fall. And let's see. I mean, what I would like, just like speaking for myself as just a regular voter, I don't want to be like naive or everything like that. We've been like seeing so many political processes and organizations and always representative politics has like something very ugly to it. So, I don't know. We cannot like maybe dream about like the ideal horizontal organization, etc.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, as Gerbaudo says, I mean, it's in some ways the digital party is the party model for our current moment. And, you know, it reflects the sort of means at our disposal for political organization, etc. In some ways, I guess with Podemos, what happened was it took some of this model and some of the sort of necessary means of political organization in the current moment and turned them into a virtue, no? Like something, you know,
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think that, of course, I mean, I'm very interested, like, in the discussions of historical party forms, right, and how to think about a party form for the 21st century. And, of course, we cannot, like, aspire maybe to the classical mass party anymore, of course, because the society is very different, etc. At the same time, I think that it's important to, of course, while we use so many, like, online media, social media, this kind of like flexible online structures, etc. We can integrate that. I think precisely because we want to go beyond neoliberalism, we are against capitalism and neoliberalism, we need to provide territorial bodies and spaces to encounter, not just like the online thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, because it's a matter of, again, and I'm very classical in this regard, it's a matter of building hegemony and cultural, a whole cultural world around the party, or not just around the party at the center. But I think that, I don't know, for example, in the case of Sumar, I think it has like many challenges in the coming future, but one would be how to integrate participation in an honest and useful way, and pragmatically, but at the same time, honestly, like it's like maybe, yeah, maybe one lesson of the previous cycle is that, yeah, we don't really need like 100% horizontal structures, because maybe that's a fallacy somehow. It's like, yeah, we know that political world works like differently. It's like, it's not about like having this pure form of horizontality, etc. But at the same time, of course, integrating participation in a meaningful way, which really is like, okay, the work of people, everyday sympathizers, militants, etc., really counts for something. It's not just like a circle, for example, in Podemos, and then, yeah, okay, yeah, you can have your own circle, but that's it. you are not going to be able to influence in any meaningful decision in the party, right? So that's one thing. Another thing would be like the presence in territories, and I think that one advantage of Sumar, depending on how Sumar configures itself, but thinking now not so much about Movimiento Sumar, which is like the specific organization, but maybe what Sumar represents all over the country with all the coalition. I think it's important maybe just to think about like how to do political work in the territories, in the specific territories. I think that one disadvantage that Podemos had and Podemos was unable to develop is like a really strong, meaningful territorial presence. And I think this is going to proof key, I think, if we take into account like that now Vox is going to be in many autonomous communities or many cities. So it's like it's really important. I mean, it's not only about party politics. Well, that's another thing that maybe we can conclude that later, about the role of social movements and how to recompose social movements in this context, which I think it goes well beyond parties and political system. But I think it's going to be key in the next few years.
I mean, I guess going back to the elections, I mean, where, just to maybe sum up, I mean, where do you see things going in the next few months? I mean, it's very, very uncertain in a sense, you know. If you had to say, what would you say? I mean, will there be a second progressive coalition, or are we looking at repeat elections in December, January?
Yeah, I think, well, in the next few months, I think the government is going to happen. There's going to be the support. I don't know. Maybe, of course, everything is very very volatile, etc. But my impression is that Junts will support the investiture and then have a new progressive coalition government. Then, of course, I think the main thing for the coming months, I think, is going to be what you mentioned already, like how it's going to play out, this contrast between national politics and local and autonomic regional politics, like the way which Vox is going to push forward. I think we are going to see is basically a territorialization of cultural wars, which think is going to, as we said, be tragic and very difficult to stomach. But but then I think it's going to be key, as we were just saying, like how the left, broadly speaking, beyond parties, like the social movements, just like civil society in many regards, how a certain like progressive social fabric reacts to that and can lead, even again, before the parties lead the struggle against the measures that many right-wing governments are going to take at their local level or at their regional level. So I think that's going to be a key thing in the next months. Speaking about like that possible new conjuncture, I think that of course there are like many issues, like, or many topics that are going to be present in the coming months or even years. But basically, I think just like enumerating like certain problems that I think are going to be there in the agenda. But one is the territorial issue, I think, in the plurinational sense, but also maybe in terms of the equality among different regions, right, or different parts of the country. In the sense of, for example, I'm speaking as an Aragonese now, but for example, for me, I think the plurinational question is not only about something that pertains to Catalonia and Basque Country and Galicia or Andalusia, which are like charismatic regions in the country, but it's about, for example, this problem of the España vaciada, right? The empty at Spain.
Yeah.
And I think this is going to be a key question in many senses, because I think it connects with something that you mentioned already, like, for example, the power of the right in the rural areas, for example, and how Vox is already trying to instrumentalize like these feelings of dispossession, of abandonment in the rural areas, which is real. But then, of course, Vox just instrumentalizes that, and then they want to do fracking all over Spain, basically. Then again, another aspect of that is it's the territorial question in connection with the ecological question and the climate question. So it's like also the something that we saw this year, for example, with Alberto Garzón as the consumption minister, is like all this controversy about the macro granjas, right? I don't
know. Industrial size farming. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. This kind of thing. So it's like really an ecological problem, but also, of course, an economic problem in terms of how you generate employment in certain areas as these monopolies operating in this, in Aragon, in my region, is extremely serious. This problem. Then what else? So it's like, of course, type of climate issues, I think, are going to be key, and I think there is a great front of ecological politics to be developed, both from the government, the central government, but also the different types of activism and social movements. I think that, for example, and this is just an aside, but one important thing in the coming years is how the left or progressive forces can develop and I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I mean, there are already many things going on. But I don't know how to challenge this apparently like hegemony of the right in the rural world. I think it's really key for ecological.
Sorry, the hegemony of the right in...
In the rural...
Oh, in rural areas, yes.
From a sort of ecologist point of view. Like how to develop like a sort of vision that of the country and of the rural world that is also appealing for farmers, for people living there, and in a way, I don't know, it's of course more ecologically just and climatically just, but also of course appealing to those parts of the population. And a couple more things, maybe. I think the issue of the justice reform, justice is part of the... Actually, I don't know if I mentioned that earlier, but basically, it's part of the... An important part of this reactionary wave has been, of course, the control of the blockage that the right has made from the...
On judicial power, exactly. Yeah, it's sort of similar, I guess, again, to this, maybe some of the tactics used in the United States. You have a very politicized judiciary, and you have this sort of artificial control of the judicial power in Spain at the moment.
No, exactly. And it's also, I think it's part of the, again, I don't know if I mentioned this already, but for example, for me, I think it's one of the, when I speak about Vox as a symptom, for example, it's important to take into account the support that Vox has among judiciary, I don't know. It's like, for me, again, Vox is not like a conventional party, but it's more like an instrument of different, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, no, it's an instrument of different powers, but also of part of the state, like the judiciary and obviously the army and the police, that, well, basically Vox represent very well their, I don't know, their feeling of being threatened by transformation in the country. And I don't know.
They draw, yeah, I mean, they, as a party, they draw their leadership, a lot of their leading cadre from the state apparatus in that sense, you know, and it's not a question. It's a sort of hangover maybe of the dictatorship in some ways from decades, you know, that you would have this sort of intersection of the Pepe, the religious right, and these elements within the state, above all around, the sort of coercive apparatus, now the judiciary, the police, the army, etc. I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, when you look at Vox's candidates, I mean, it's hardly a conspiracy when you just look at what jobs where they come from. They are ex-generals, they are ex-police commissioners or state attorneys or judges. I mean, there's a few bullfighters in there for sort of color, etc., but it's a lot of their leading cadre, with the exception of Abascal and a few others who came from the Pepe, who were, I think, in his opinion piece in The Guardian, Gordon Brown described Vox as, you know, as moving from sort of backstreet demagogues to the cabinet. But I mean, that might be true of sort of Le Pen or something like that, but it's not true of the far right in Spain.
Yeah, it's true. Totally right. No, and I mean, just to conclude, for example, like overcoming this blockage of the judiciary power by the right, but it's also, yeah, the thing is how that blocks also possible developments in terms of, yeah, the territorial model or other decisions that need to be made. So it's like a really meaningful there. And then a last aspect that I would like to highlight, maybe it's a question of rights, basically, how we are going to be able, if we are able to follow, for example, what the feminist movement have been pointing towards in the last few years, but then, of course, with this reactionary wave has been like somehow stopped. And for example, issues like the trans rights, and if there can be like more progress in that. And here, of course, we need to remember the work that Irene Montero did in the Ministerio de Igualdad. So it's really, really important to vindicate that. And also other issues, like, for example, issues like housing, I think are also important. Like, yeah. I'm thinking right now, for example, the way in which housing has become part of the front of the reactionary wave, also in the ways in which they've been like, I don't know, appealing to these discourses of security, of fear.
Housing is framed in terms of squatting as opposed to precarious contracts and evictions and, you know, yeah, mortgage arrears of 10 years ago. I mean, one last thing I was going to ask actually was about, because it slightly related to this, I think, in that sense, is the role of the trade unions, because in a sense the trade unions have been a key supporter of this government, and particularly of Yolanda Díaz, her agenda in the Labour Ministry. And in a sense, one of the distinctions maybe when you see sort of strike waves happening in France or in the UK and to a lesser extent in the United States is the degree of industrial peace maybe in Spain, and how can the unions position themselves here? Because in a sense, they are in an alliance with the current government, a key social ally. You know, the pact of the last 4 years in some ways, particularly since the cost of living crisis, has been, okay, industrial, low level of industrial action, but with progressive reforms around pensions, around the labor reform, minimum wage would be raised above, you know.
Of course, I guess that the international factors are going to determine like what can be done economically, and then in terms of the work of Yolanda Díaz in the work labor ministry, these kind of things. I guess that one, I don't know, just like expressing like a sort of like a desire somehow. It's like, I don't know, it would be interesting, I think, that even if there is like a cooperation from the unions with the labor ministry, presumably Yolanda Díaz is still there. I don't know, it would be great maybe if the unions can have like a more like presence also in the street somehow.
Yeah.
Not even maybe protesting directly the government, but somehow I think that, for example, very focused on this issue of territorialization, and then, for example, how maybe unions can become a meaningful actor even beyond labor issues, like supporting mobilizations, for example, against certain measures at the regional level, different cultural issues, different defense of rights. I don't know. It could be. I think that the major unions are more or less conservative in different ways, organizationally and so on. But I think it would be interesting maybe to, I don't know, given that there is a sort of favorable government, well, how can they engage maybe in other struggles or support other struggles that also help them to transform themselves a little bit as social forces? And another thing, maybe it's not answering your question directly, but I think it's true. For example, around Yolanda Díaz, there has been this discussion or these questions about this new sort of laborismo, right? Which is, yeah, in the UK, it's or in the Anglo-Saxon world, it's more common word, but it's in the Spanish context, it's kind of new. Somehow, like speaking about like this sort of laborismo as a sort of more or less defined specific political program project.
Yeah.
And, I mean, definitely Yolanda Díaz comes from this union world and she's the labor minister, etc. That's like her professional experience also as labor lawyer, etc. And she's very, I mean, capable and knowledgeable about all this. But then how, I don't know, I really wonder how this laborismo will look like how can be conceived of a left politics that are based on labor, of course, and that's, I think it's great because it's a huge tradition, of course, in the left, that's no question about it. But then how can we imagine a politics, let's call it laborismo if you want, but then that basically is truth to the traditions of the left and the unionism, etc., but of course at the same time integrating new labor realities and also new social realities and then connecting labor and other issues like with rights, sexual rights or anti-racism, support to migrants or all these kind of struggles, and then how this addition of this new label, let's say, of laborismo can help to stimulate leftist politics in the coming.
Great. Well, look, I mean, I think it's been a very, very thorough discussion of the current moment. Vicente, thank you so much for joining me.
No, thanks to you, really. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Great. No, really interesting conversation. Thanks a lot.